What if your greatest strength as a leader, your desire to help, was quietly holding you and your team back? In this episode, you'll learn how to transform that impulse into sustainable leadership that inspires growth, independence, and resilience for you and your team.
Welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, a podcast helping human-centered leaders master communication to accelerate your team's performance, reduce stress, and build a career with the respect and influence you deserve. I'm your host, David Dye, president of Let's Grow Leaders.
Hey, welcome to the show. In this episode, we're going to address one of the darker sides of human-centered leadership and get some critical strategies to help shift your thinking if you're an overhelper. If you struggle with compulsive helping or feel compelled to keep helping your team or business, even to the detriment of your own well-being, this episode is going to help you shift your beliefs, invest in your health so you have the strength to be a genuine support to your team, and you'll give your team a chance to develop their strength and skills to be more productive, independent, and resilient. And here to help us do all that is Jess Baker, a chartered psychologist, leadership coach, and author of a new book, The Super Helper Syndrome. I love this title, A Survival Guide for Compassionate People. Jess Baker is joining us from Wales today. Jess, welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's great to be here.
Oh, I am so looking forward to this conversation. I definitely, as I read through your book, this is one of those books, I know that you get this all the time. I wish I would have read this book 35 years ago. It would have been so helpful. And, you know, many of these things I've had to learn, still in progress learning some of these. So I can't wait to share these with the audience. So just let's start with just a definition here. Super helper. What are we talking about? As people are listening right now, and they're like, is this episode for me? What's a super helper?
Sure. A super helper is someone that falls into a pattern of helping others that falls into a kind of compulsive need. They feel compelled to help others. And the title of the book and the title of the syndrome, the super helper syndrome, doesn't touch on a medical diagnosis. I'm using the definition here of a collection of emotions and behaviors that we can get sucked into. So the super helper syndrome is when you're overhelping to the detriment of your own well-being. You're giving and giving and giving, and then you feel exhausted, you feel resentful, or you don't want to feel resentful. You can be exploited by others who come to you continually for help, or, you know, asking ever bigger questions and asking more of you for help. And there's also the self-criticism that can come on the back of all this, thinking, I shouldn't feel this resentful. I should be more compassionate. I should be able to give and give and give without falling over. So that's kind of super helper syndrome in a nutshell.
And you just both identified what it is, as well as some of the, you know, consequences when we have this unhealthy relationship with helping, the downsides that you mentioned: exhaustion, you mentioned being taken advantage of, you mentioned this self-critical voice that folks can have. And I missed, there was one or two others in there, I think, as well, some of the negative side effects.
Yeah. So exhaustion is obviously the kind of physical tiredness that one gets when one just fills one's schedule again and again and keeps saying yes and yes and yes to things. Resentment is when there's an imbalance in a relationship and you feel that imbalance. You haven't really chosen that imbalance. So often now, I mean, you said earlier that it's the kind of book you wish you'd read 30 years ago. It's the kind of book I wish I read 30 years ago as well. That imbalance means it's a sign, you know, and it's going to cause resentment if you don't put some boundaries in place. We can come back to boundaries and talk about practicalities later on and techniques. So that resentment comes from an imbalance in the relationships where you feel like you're giving more than you're getting back. There's also exploitation, you know, that sense that other people are just taking you for granted. Because you're saying yes, they come to you first. Because you say yes, they ask ever more of you. And because you say yes, you find it really difficult to say no, and you don't say no for a number of reasons, including that you feel guilty when you do. And you feel like, again, it's doing yourself some disservice because you see yourself as a helper. So I can talk about the self-image as well, if you like.
Yeah, we'll get it. I think we'll get into that. One of the other side effects, negative consequences of being a super helper, when you're in a leadership role, and doing that is that you actually disempower your team. You're frequently, your team is not growing and developing the resiliency and skills that they would need. And I know this because I was that leader. And we've, you know, past episodes, listeners would might recognize some of those where, you know, always jumping in with the answer, always jumping in with the help for all the various reasons we'll get into. But you're also keeping you're limiting your team as well as all of the negative effects on yourself.
Yeah, quite right. You're not allowing them to grow and develop and make their own mistakes if you're micromanaging or doing everything because you're afraid of delegating, or you don't want to kind of let go of the apron strings. You know, if you've seen, if you, because a lot of people who I work with are empathic, they love and find it comes very easy to them to develop others. And so they'll take a kind of nurturing role, if you like, in that other person's career development, and they feel proud of themselves for doing that. But sometimes at the same time, they also hold other people back, you know, because they want to do everything for them. They feel like they should be doing things and they should be doing more, so they don't delegate, they don't allow other people to make their own mistakes. And actually, there's another side to this, David, if I may. A lot of the people that come to me for coaching say, in essence, I focus so hard and so much on other people and helping others in their career and in their professional development, I haven't looked at my own. And I've seen them go up the ladder and I'm still left behind. You know, so person A, who I was developing 5 or 6 years ago, is now my senior leader. And that sucks, you know, and how the hell did I get here? So it causes a number of different issues, but...
You know, and I see this issue come up frequently with our clients and with heart and human-centered leaders. You know, just yesterday I was on site with some clients. We're doing a workshop, and one of the participants raised her hand and said, you know, listen, I'm very committed to servant leadership. I want to be supportive of my team. I want to lead by example. And the conversation we were having about where is that line? And she was saying, you know, I want to dive in and help my team do all the things that they need to do. And I want to never ask my team something I wouldn't do. And, you know, that leadership cliche, which has truth to it. And yet, if I'm only doing that, I'm not doing the things that only I can do as a leader and manager. So where's the line? So I thought, you know, just as I was having that discussion yesterday, knowing you and I were getting ready to record this episode today, I thought, you know, what good
time. And what did you say?
opened it to the group. We had a panel of leaders in the room. So they all talked about how they've navigated that themselves. And that one of the answers that I thought was very pertinent it's about communication with the team also, of, because the team has expectations as a leader. Well, why aren't you helping? So you've got to navigate your own expectations and beliefs, which we'll get into in a moment, but also there's communicating to your team. Hey, listen, team, you have me for the next 45 minutes. And then I've got this meeting or this work that I have got to get done to do X, Y, or Z. How can I be most helpful in this 45 minutes? And so, you know, you were mentioning boundaries earlier, but it's bounding the time and bounding what one can expect, and then creating clarity around that.
Yeah, contracting with them. And you know, being the role model for those boundaries too, by saying, I'm not going to email you at weekends and I don't expect you to email me at weekends. By the way, if I do have to email you, I'm not expecting a response till Monday, you know. And I think it's really important for people to realize that you become a role model. A lot of the work I do at the moment on my YouTube channel is focused on empathic people in professional roles and how maybe you, have never been taught how to transfer your beautiful, supportive helper self into a strategic thinking leader. And I think I'm trying to bridge that gap by saying, you were the invisible supporter. You've been on the sidelines. You've been happy in the sidelines, to be honest, you know, until now, for whatever reason, you've realized that other people are going ahead of you and you're not developing your career, or you're not seen as the credible person that people, maybe in teams and meetings, you still play the supportive mediator rather than the one sharing your own opinions because you're still afraid that people aren't going to like what you've got to say. So I try and deal with all those different everyday issues and try to articulate, which I may or may not be doing well at the moment, that leap from How do I remain empathic? How do I express my empathy as a leader now? Because I don't want to lose it. Like that person saying to you, I want to be the servant leader. And I really don't like that phrase, by the way. But how can I be an empathic person as I am without losing any of my integrity, without having to harden up or become less sensitive, because that is a power too. And how can I express it in a way that helps others more? You know, in my leadership role, I have a bigger presence. I can support others. And actually, I can look back down the ladder for those who haven't come up it yet. And I can be the voice, the role model, the one to help them have more agency, as you know. And so I think there's some beautiful work to be done in this space.
Absolutely. And as you, I'm so glad that you're having that conversation via the channel and the work that you're doing, because we need more leaders with that level of empathy and strategic impact and learning how to transition and navigate and have that broader and scale that empathy at an organizational level. Well, there are skills and there are mindsets and there are things that are required to do that. So it's part of that process. You've got that superpower. Let's figure out how to channel it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, one of the points that you make in the book, Jess, is that for maybe a listener who's identifying, okay, yes, I hear myself. I see myself in what you're saying, that it's not necessarily a quick fix, flip a switch type of solution when we're addressing, if I'm recognizing myself, okay, it's not just a one switch I'm going to flip. There's some work to do here and some mindset, some patterns that we might need to adjust. And one of the points that you make in that, I love this phrase in the book, your brain isn't wired, I'm going to make this sure I read this correctly. Your brain is not wired to make you feel good about yourself. It's wired to protect you. And, you know, we like practical skills and tools and so forth, but this one is one of those awareness things that if we can really latch on and understand that and have that self-awareness of how our brains work, really helps us with a lot of the things that we need to do moving forward, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think understanding that the mindset of a super helper, somebody who has a lot of empathy, someone who does also have compassion. So to be clear, should we just define those phrases? I'm not sure how you use them, but I'd like to just explain how I use those terms. So empathy, you have two types of empathy. Cognitive empathy is I understand how you feel. And you might even said someone, I know how you feel. Yeah, that same thing happened to me, you know, and we say those things. And it's an understanding that that person is going through a particular situation that we might relate to. We also have emotional empathy. And emotional empathy says, I feel with you. In fact, it comes from a German word, Einfühlung, I think. Forgive my pronunciation. But it's about feeling into. So it could be about feeling people's pain. And I feel how you feel. And I'm sorry you're suffering. But it could also be joyful. And this is where I love the difference between empathy and compassion. And my book, The Super Helper Syndrome, was all focused on compassion. And I set out the case beautifully for that, I think. Obviously, I'm biased, but. And in the work I do now, I backtrack to empathy, which is the precursor for compassion. So if you have empathy, you can say, I know and I understand your suffering. I feel your pain. And compassion says, I want to do something about it to help you. What can I do? How can I help? Right. And that's this beautiful movement towards compassionate leadership. And we've seen that for 5, 10 years now in the leadership space. Right. There are a number of holes in that. And I'd love to go through that with you if there's time. But for now, let me stay on focus, because otherwise I might forget where I was going. So then we have, but we also have empathy, which is, as I've said, the precursor to compassion. Empathy can be joyful. Empathy can also be, I feel your excitement. I'm laughing because you're laughing, but I have no idea why you're laughing. You know, like, have you ever watched any of those memes of babies giggling or whatever? It's just weirdly funny and we don't need to know why. So
I have been one of those memes.
Have you?
Well, not in a viral sense, but I certainly have been in those situations where I'm just laughing because everyone's laughing or that other person's laughing. And it's just, yeah, absolutely.
That emotional contagion is beautiful. So I really want to step back to thinking and focusing on empathy, because it's not just about being the servant leader or being the compassionate leader when things go wrong. It's about knowing how to focus when things go right. and knowing how we can express ourselves as leaders in a joyful way. I mean, that sounds cheesy, but in a way that isn't always just about pain and suffering. Do you know what I mean? There's enough of that in business. But there are also things that go right. There are also loads of things that go well. How can we also focus on that and learn from that and move those things forward too?
I think that's such a critical skill. In our organization, we talk about post-project celebrations as opposed to post-mortems or after-action reviews and things, because there's something that went well, something went right. Are we lifting that up? Are we celebrating? And so often in that, since you bring it up, there's an opportunity to learn what went well that we even weren't expecting or hadn't planned on. And if we can hold on to that, identify it, wow, that gives us a chance to build. But as you say, so often we're focused on the negative and the pain and suffering and, oh, well, what was the one thing that went wrong? And we miss all of those joyful success lessons that were there for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember appreciative inquiry? That was the thing back in the day. And
oh, yes.
That's where I feel like there's a thread back to that, to say what worked well, how can we do more of that? You know, and I think a lot of the organizations I work with get me in, and probably the same for you, because there is a problem. And they miss the wins, yet they sometimes overlook or downplay the strengths or the things that have been going right. And I think sometimes, as you've said, David, so true. There was so much to learn from that too. So yeah, it's fascinating.
I can tell, Jess, that our half hour for this conversation is not going to be anywhere near enough, but we're going to do the best we can for our listeners here. You know, I want to take you back to something you said earlier about that criticality, that self-criticism that happens. I think many listeners, I know I can identify with it, many listeners can identify. And in the book, you talk about, you get a real practical skill to start helping people navigate those shoulds and musts and all those things and that voice. And you're not doing enough. You're not good enough. You shouldn't be feeling, you mentioned the exhaustion. You shouldn't be feeling exhausted. Well, of course you should, right? And you had a skill in the book, as I recall, was about decentering. And I thought that was a really practical way to start helping people who say, yeah, I got that voice, to start navigating some of those thoughts.
That's a really lovely tool. I'm so glad you mentioned it. It's so simple. It's actually from a book I never wrote on body image. When I was doing some research on that 10 years ago or so, one of many I haven't written maybe yet, who knows? And it came up with body image research for younger people, actually, younger boys and girls. And decentering is based on cognitive behavioral therapy, where you're working with your thoughts. So you're becoming aware of your thinking patterns. And to you and I, and maybe to most of your listeners, that's like, yeah, I know what I think. I know I have an inner critic, and I know I have this, and I know I have some self-doubt, and I know. But, you know, sometimes we can't all access it as well as we could. And I think this is part of, again, it comes back to being empathic. We can understand others so well. We can tune into others. We can read them. We can read the micro expressions. We sense a vibe, you know, that we can't put our finger on. And actually, we need to be turning that skill to ourselves as well, and becoming more and more self-aware and uncovering this too, to understand our unconscious mind. So come back to decentering. It's such a short and simple way, an approach to manage your reaction to the inner critic. But actually, the difficult part is to remember to do it in the moment. It's like, just, I send my coaching clients off with the homework. You know, they're like, yeah, oh yeah, there was that thing. Yeah, I totally forgot to do that. You know, yeah, okay, don't worry. It's going to take practice. There's no overnight fix. And decentering, if I can just explain it then in a few steps, is simply adding a prefix to your thought. So you have to be able to capture that thought, like, let's say a classic one, right? I hear all the time, not necessarily related to work, but it's like, I should have gone to the gym this week. But then you say to that person, okay, when did you last go to? Oh, last Sunday. Okay, so you have been going to the gym, you just haven't gone this week yet. Okay, so I should have gone to the gym. There's a nice should in there, this tyrannical command, this internal tyrannical command. And with that thought, albeit seemingly so innocent, and maybe some people would say, well, that's helpful because that motivates me to get to the gym. And I'd say, no, it's not helpful because it's negative. And it's not motivating you to get to the gym. What's motivating you is your reaction to that thought. So your thoughts have a behavioral and emotional consequence. If your thought is full of a should, it's going to have a negative consequence. In other words, oh yeah, I feel really bad now. I feel really bad about myself because I haven't done that thing that my ideal self would have done, you know, in a multiverse or out there in many possible worlds, you know, there's a very fit version of me going to the gym every single day, whatever. So I'm less than because I'm not meeting my own idealistic standards. I'm less than. So this thought is now, as we know, quite a horrible thought and quite a berating thought. And we would never say it to a friend or a child. Why would we say it to ourselves? But we do. So we hold this thought. I should have gone to the gym. And in front of that thought, I'm going to add the prefix. I am having the thought that dot, dot, dot. I should have gotten to the gym. And that's it. That's decentering. It's called decentering because you are taking yourself out of the center in that moment of that thought. And you can almost see it written down. I say to people, if you can't write it down in a journal, imagine it written on the wall in front of you or the screen in front of you. I'm having the thought that dot, dot, dot. I should have X, Y, Z. I shouldn't be. I should have said that thing. I shouldn't be doing this, that, and the other. You know, whatever tyrannical commands you're using in your own head. What do you think about? Did you find, have you practiced it, David? Or did you find it useful? Or what do you think, you know, is valuable in that example?
As you're describing it, and the reason that I find it valuable is it is one of those, how do you break that chain, break that cycle of that kind of thinking? And one of the thinking habits I developed for myself, and this is my own metaphor. I didn't read this particular one. There's some others that I have come across, but I thought about it as an American baseball glove, right? And somebody throws an apple to you. I'm not required to catch that apple in my mouth and consume it. I can catch it in the glove and inspect it and then decide what I want to do with it. Do I want to set it aside? Do I want to swallow it? And I see a similarity as you're describing this of, I am not that thought. I'm having that thought. Now that gives me some agency. That gives me some choice. Is there something here that I can, what should I do with this thought? And how do I examine it? What do I, you know, do I set it aside? Do I,
yeah,
there is something for me here. And it's maybe trying to tell me something else that could be positive. And so I'm curious where you go next with some of these shoulds and musts when you say, I should go to the gym. No, I'm having the thought I should go to the gym. Where do we go then?
Well, firstly, I love that analogy of the baseball glove. That's fantastic. I think it's absolutely right. And I think it's to the point because when we're having those critical thoughts, we're in our own headspace, which isn't ever going to help you get out of your headspace because it's, your brain is wired to protect you, not to make you happy, right? So it's going to want to prevent you from doing things that humiliate yourself or making any errors, etc. And I think to try and stay with that thought or that point, you're helping yourself choose how you respond. As you use that baseball analogy and as you use decentering, I'm having the thought that, okay, so instead of automatically having an emotional consequence where I feel even worse about myself and I start berating myself and listing all the other things I haven't done today, let alone last week, you know, you then look at it and say, okay, it's just a thought. Ah, do you know what? I've had that thought 5 times today. 100 times in the last week, 10,000 times in my lifetime, maybe more. And how boring, how utterly boring and uncreative, because I know that almost everyone else in the world who lives in a similar environment to me, you know, is probably experiencing the same kind of thought. And that's really unimaginative as well. So I then begin to unpack that with my clients and I'll say, it's not just you having the kind of thought like that. You've had those thoughts before. I might ask them to or invite them to figure out where that thought came from. It might have been something someone said to you, about you, or even in front of you. I mean, this is an example that's really random. I'll try and be quick. But a coaching client once said to me, Jess, you know, I have this thought, it's recurring, it's really silly. Okay, great. We can work with silly, random, inner critical thoughts. By the way, you just called it silly, so I can hear that judgment as well. There's another layer, brilliant. And she said, every time I write an address or I write a letter or I write in my journal, there's a voice that says, your handwriting is terrible. And I said, okay, where's that from? You know, let's unpack that. And it turned out, and she had to kind of dig down and kind of give it some time and some space. But the next time we met, she came back, she said, "I think it's from primary school. I think it's when my primary school teacher said, your handwriting is messy. This is terrible." And she held it up in front of the whole class. And I said, "My goodness, so it was your handwriting." "Oh, no, no, no. The boy sitting next to me." So it was actually her brain had latched on to the criticism of the boy sitting next to her as some kind of truth about her.
Wow.
How crazy is this? So we live with this in our head. We go through life living by these. And I use the word tyrannical command because that was one of Karen Horney's phrases. And she wrote long and well on neuroticism and her own neuroticism too, and the inner critic and her life with her inner dialogue. So I think knowing where it comes from is one of the other things. And then, of course, learning how to slowly acknowledge it. I run a program called Tame Your Inner Critic, and I've over 1,000 people have been through that. And I focus very much on befriending your inner critical thoughts, getting closer to them, knowing them better than they know themselves. Like, so you can almost anticipate it then, and you feel agency rather than the victim. You can say, "Oh, that's a boring one. I've had that loads of times. Does it really mean anything right now? Is it helpful? What should I be doing instead?" And you can kind of go through a little checklist of things you could be doing to help you refocus on the thing that does actually matter that's in front of you.
And when you do choose to go to the gym, back to that example, you're choosing for a positive motivation and
yes,
to feel good, to be healthy, to all the positive reasons.
Yeah, you're motivating yourself through self-compassion and saying, "Actually, I want to go to the gym. I choose to go to the gym because I'm going to feel really good about myself, and it means if I'm healthier, then I live longer for me and for my family." You know, and you can think about all the ripple effects that that might have in the future.
And now, listener, replace going to the gym with any of the 100 different leadership shoulds or musts that you have in your mind at the moment. So Jess, as we are getting close to the end of time here, I definitely want to dive into the irrational beliefs briefly and maybe even a little bit about deconstruction or boundaries. I don't know where we'll go. But before any of that, can you tell our listeners, I hope that they're getting a sense of, oh, wow, there is so much here that will be helpful for me. Where to find your book? Give us the name of the book again, where to find it, where to find you. You mentioned your YouTube channel. Anything that is going to be helpful that where we can connect with you.
Thank you. Yeah. So the book is called The Super Helper Syndrome, A Survival Guide for Compassionate People. It can be found everywhere online and in your independent bookshop. They'll be able to order it, I think, wherever you are in the world, including the US. It's come out in other languages too. So if you're keen, Japanese, Polish, Chinese, and Turkish. and I am, my handle on social media on every platform is at Jess Baker Psych, PSYCH, short for psychologist. So feel free to link in with me, connect, DM me, email me, whatever. That would be great. I love hearing from listeners. There's so much more to discuss. And right now on my YouTube channel that's called Powered by Empathy, I am focusing on a playlist where I highlight the benefits of being empathic. There's so many things and so many other people talking about empathy the whole time, how terrible it is and how empathy can go into overdrive. And I am that person too. But there are I've found 21 ways. Now I found loads more. 21 ways being empathic can benefit you in a leadership role or at work. So I'm currently working through that. So yeah, thanks.
Fantastic. All right, listeners, lots of good resources for you to continue this conversation. So Jess, as we get close to the end of our time here, we've talked about some of the beliefs and things that can drive super helper syndrome. You identify four in the book: the good person belief, the help everyone belief, the they couldn't survive without me belief, guilty as charged. Number four, the no needs belief.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, maybe just walk us through one of those just so we get a sense of what these beliefs are, how they drive some of the behaviors that we've been talking about. And I know it's hard in a limited amount of time, but even, you know, you go through four steps of what we do to start deconstructing or separating or freeing ourselves from some of these beliefs.
Yeah, I can group the first three because the first three, I'm impressed that you've read the book, and I'm so glad because you wouldn't believe how many people interview me and they don't have a clue. But thank you so much for putting the time in, and I
As an
appreciate how
author,
much.
I would completely understand how many people don't. Yes, I understand.
Yeah. So I'm really grateful for your highlighting this because I think it's so relevant. In fact, it won the Business Book Awards in the well-being sector. And I think those three beliefs, the first three, the good person belief, I must help everyone, and the they couldn't survive without me belief, are all, if you can put those in a bucket, those are all driving compulsive helping. And those alone don't necessarily mean that you're falling into super helper syndrome. You might be overgiving, but you might also have boundaries and saying, well, I'm choosing, and this is one of the phrases I use, I'm choosing my helping boundaries. I'm choosing who I help, when I help, and how I help. However, if you take any one of those three three irrational beliefs, and they still are irrational, and we can go into that in a minute, plus sign the no needs belief, that's when it topples over into it's detrimental to your own well-being. If you hold the no needs belief, you are ultimately saying to yourself and others, I don't have any needs. Your needs matter more. And at the same time, my needs matter less. Now, you've heard people say, put on your oxygen mask before you put on others. I like to use a watering can analogy. Like you can't water your plants if there's no water in the watering can, right? For me, that has a more kind of nurturing thing. And I do live in rural Wales, so maybe rain and watering and plant growth is important to me. But there's this sense that, in fact, someone recently said to me, it feels like I'm setting myself on fire to keep others warm. And I think that's a really vivid image. So this no needs belief is the one that can really trick you into compulsive helping. And it's the one that prevents you from asking for help too, because you see yourself as a helper. So the first three very much all feed into your role as the helper, not the helpee, not the person receiving help, but it feeds your self-image. I'm a good person, therefore I must help. If I must help everyone, then I must help everyone. That person in the street, that close relative, that person all over the world. And you suddenly, I've met and I've interviewed, I'm interviewed over 50 people for the book, and I could have kept going, and they kept referring people, and they are from all over the world in different walks of life and from different industries too, where they say, I have given more of myself than I needed to, and I didn't realize at the time. I felt like I needed to be needed. There's an element of self-importance that's wrapped up in this. I call it the helper's pride. And it's not self, it's not that self-satisfying, but it is a kind of a pride you take in, like, no, I can carry on. I can just squeeze in one more thing, and I can just do this. Yes, I can do that thing for you, even though I'm absolutely exhausted. I'm already resentful of our relationship because I'm the one that's doing everything for you, but I see myself as a good person, and therefore I feel like every time I'm asked a request for help, I must say yes because it's like a test that I have to pass. Oh, it's exhausting.
It is. I'm just smiling because I lived a good portion of my life that way. So it's one of the reasons that when I saw your book, I'm like, we have to get this in front of our listeners or in our listeners' ears. So as listeners are sitting here going, wow, yeah, okay. See myself, recognize those patterns. We don't have time to solve them all right now, but you've got a lot of resources to help with that. Briefly, you walk us through a way, four steps or layers to deconstruct these irrational beliefs in the book. And just to highlight so that listeners have a path forward and hopefully go get the book if they can use the help right now. I'm wondering if you can walk us through those, acknowledging, exposing as irrational, identifying it as harmful, and ultimately letting it go.
Yeah, definitely. Did you notice that there are actually five steps? It's not help, it's help. It's a little joke we put in. No one, like 3 years later, no one's noticed. But Rod and I had fun. By the way, Rod, my co-author, was also my partner and a psychologist. So we sat side by side and debating So the deconstructing the irrational beliefs, there are a number of stages. Acknowledging that you hold the belief, because sometimes, and I have experienced all of this myself, David, everything in the book, more or less. Acknowledging you hold the belief is actually one of the most difficult things to do, because you think, well, but if I'm not helping, and I have actually said this, who am I? Like, what am I? But I must help everyone. I should be helping people, you know. Why wouldn't I? Like, what else am I on this earth to do? And, you know, lo and behold, look at my career path. Look at what I'm doing now. So acknowledging you hold the belief, sometimes it's difficult to do that, but it's about understanding, okay, this is a belief I am holding myself to. Then you expose it as irrational, because this belief is holding you to some irrational standards. Especially if you believe, you know, you must help everyone, or I must help others to prove I'm a good person. But what if you stopped helping? Even one of my interviewees said, I worry about my daughter, and she was referring to her daughter who had a personality disorder, who is now an adult herself. But she said, you know, this woman I was interviewing in her late 60s says, but what happens when I can't help her? You know, does that make me not a good person, even though I physically might just age and not be, and maybe I'll even be dead and not here? So acknowledging the belief is irrational, and it's holding you in this little space where you believe you must help others to prove you're a good person, or that these other people have to rely on you and you alone. You're exposing the belief as harmful. As I said, you know, every belief has, and every thought has a consequence, behavioral consequence, an emotional consequence. Ultimately, you know, I've already labeled the four different detriments you can experience as a result of having super helper syndrome: the exhaustion, the resentment, the exploitation, and the self-criticism as well. It is harmful. And we've already discussed it from the very outset. If you're a leader who is high in empathy, or a super helper, as this person came to you saying, I want to be a servant leader, maybe it's harmful to your team as well. If you're not delegating, you're not letting them grow. You're not letting them make mistakes and learn from them. Then, of course, you have to let go of the belief. Whoa, this is super difficult. Now, I talk about each of the beliefs in turn, and they each have their own chapter and some history around them, some explanation of them. And then also we deconstruct every single one of them in the book. And letting go of the belief is sometimes the hardest thing, because we're holding on and have held on to beliefs like, oh, but if I ask for help, then that puts me in a one down position. Or I see myself as the helper, not the person who asks. I don't want to be burdening others, but hang on a second, you're happy to be burdened. You know, oh, if it's the no needs belief, oh, if I stop and rest, then that's being selfish. You know, so we have these other thoughts that we really need to explore and examine to get to know what is going on in our heads. We need to be more self-aware, so that we can start unpacking the reasons why in order to move forward. So we put something in its place by saying, it means that you can choose a different belief. And, you know, in the book, I name the full affirmation of the alternative beliefs. My self-worth is not dependent on helping others. I know and respect the limits of my capacity to help. I know and respect the limits of my responsibility to help. I deserve to have my own needs met. And for the first time, you know, when I was writing all of this, I cried, because I felt like, wow, it was only because I've done so much personal development in the last decade or two or three that I was able to get to a place to write these from the heart, thinking I've now got to a place where I can hand on heart say and believe that these things are true for me. I am still tested. Yes. Am I human? Yes. Do I default to helping? Yes. But I also have in place those healthy helping boundaries, you know, choosing when you help, how you help, and who you help.
Oh, Jess, thank you so much. And listeners, I hope you get the sense of how rich a resource both the book and Jess's YouTube channel and all of those elements can be for you to help you shift your beliefs, invest in your health, and ultimately give your team a chance to develop their strengths, resilience, and to be more productive, independent, and so on. So as we are wrapping up, listeners, I want to encourage you to, if you're wrestling with one of those beliefs, to start to acknowledge it. Say, hey, I hold this belief. This is a thing that is happening in my mind. And then explore the exposing perhaps the irrationality, the harmful elements of it, and ultimately being able to let that go. And Jess Baker, I just want to thank you so much for your time and investing your wisdom for all of our listeners today. Thank you for being a part of the show.
Thank you so much. It's been so good to chat with you, David. I hope it's been really useful as well for some of the audience.
Likewise. Oh, I know it has. I'm confident it has. And again, our guest today has been Jess Baker. The name of the book is The Super Helper Syndrome. And if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of these practical communication skills to help you accelerate your team's performance, reduce stress, and build a career with the respect and influence you deserve. Thank you, as always, to our producer and sound engineer, Brooke Bradford at Sheep in Space Digital Business Services, making us sound good, and Laura at Brooke Marketing for the work on this episode. Until next time, be the leader you'd want your boss to be.
The UPS Store is making packing and shipping Easter gifts quicker than ever this year with UPS Air. How quick? Quicker than a walk around the park. Quicker than eating all the Easter candies. Quicker than finding a golden egg that you know is stuffed with cash. When you ship UPS Air at the UPS Store, your items arrive on time or your money back. Guaranteed at no extra cost. Exclusively at the UPS Store U.S. retail locations. Send Easter joy on time at the UPS Store. Visit theupsstore.com/airguarantee for full details. Terms and conditions apply.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.